This is Kira Kavanaugh. I'm the president of Life Meets Work, and I want to welcome all of you to our monthly member teleconference, where we give Life Meets Work members the opportunity to ask questions of us, and that we can so that we can help you with your own individual flex challenges. So the way this is going to work is that I'm going to go through a couple of questions that we've received in advance. Then I will encourage you, if you want to unmute your phone by hitting star 6 at the end of my answering those questions, so that you can ask your own questions, I would encourage you to do that. And then we'll take the remainder of the time today to go through the result of some recent manager training sessions that I've been conducting, and to share with you what some of our managers' greatest fears are with regards to flexible work and managing flexible work teams. So let's get started. The first question we received, I'm just going to read it verbatim, says, "We're coming up on award nomination season again, and if you're in Chicago, it's time to apply for the Crane's Best Places to Work Award. I'd like to take advantage of these award programs to get some free access to an employee engagement survey, but I'm worried about a possible negative impact on our organization if our results are poor." And then the questioner asks whether we have any suggestions. So first of all, I would point you to an article on our member site that talks about, that Jamie wrote, that talks about the value of applying to Best Places to Work awards, Best Workplace Awards in general, and really the marketing muscle that you can get out of doing so and winning one of those awards. Obviously, the vulnerability is, what if you don't win? And for a number of awards, including the Crane's Best Places to Work Award and the Sloan Awards for Business Excellence and Workplace Flexibility, offer a benchmarking report as part of, or as sort of in response to, as a reward for, you know, applying for the award. So that benchmark report is actually a really great vehicle for really getting some information, not only about your employees' attitudes towards your own flexible work programs, because both of those awards have not only a survey that you fill out as the HR practitioner, but also a survey that your employees or a subset of your employees fill out. It has value because you get not only the benchmarking report that benchmarks you against other external companies, but also a report that tells you kind of what the issues are, perceptions are of your employees. So this question really gets at that issue the way I'm reading it, which is, what if you get this in employee engagement survey portion back and the numbers don't look really good? So this is basically how I would answer it. For a number of organizations that are already doing employee engagement surveys, you're probably more familiar with or accustomed to kind of getting the bad news on those reports. And we know, just like we'd prefer not to get bad reviews in our annual evaluation, we also know that a lot of good can come of it. So if you're an organization who's already doing a lot of employee benchmarking or employee engagement and attitude surveys, then you know that once those results come in, the really best practice organizations take those results and determine their talent development strategies as a result. So those employee engagement surveys actually drive the priorities for the talent management group for the next year. So there is the opportunity, really, then, even if you aren't accustomed in your organization to using them for that purpose, there is the opportunity to start that process. I think the other thing is that it's always good to get, it's hard to get that information, but it's always good to get that information, because it really means that it can be another way for you to escalate the need for, or to underscore or prove the need for, a flexible work arrangement policy in your organization as a result of the results. So I think, like anything, don't be afraid of negative results. Understand that the value of negative results really can be transformational for your organization over time. So thanks. We have another question here about communication strategies to associates or employees of organizations, and it basically goes like this. I'm rolling out a flexible work policy at the end of the year. I have invested in manager training, but I'm not yet sure of how to communicate the strategy out to our employees. Do you have any suggestions? I think a big challenge here is that for many organizations, we'll focus really on training managers and getting managers up and going, getting their buy-in. Hopefully we're doing that. But oftentimes there's sort of this this fear either in some organizations that associates aren't going to, well, if we tell people about the program, if we tell employees about the program, then it means that they're all going to jump on board and want to ask all at the same time. So sometimes there can be a reluctance to not want to spread the word about a new flexible work program. In other organizations that are really very heavily into two-way communication, this question might seem a little funny. So what I would suggest is that employees, like managers, need support for flexible work programs to understand really what the motivations are behind the change, to know that the policy is being supported by the CEO or executive staff of the organization, to understand the process of applying for that flexible work arrangement. And then really the issue of culture has to be addressed. We know that even though only a certain portion of the population will use a flexible work arrangement, that more often than not, there's actually an entire employee population that wants to use a flexible work arrangement but is afraid to ask. And so part of your communication to associates really must be in helping them feel like they have that permission to ask and that the culture is going to change over time so that they're not being seen in a negative light by taking advantage of it. There are a number of sort of practical ways that you can approach this. One is certainly to be very forthcoming and actively communicating the policy, you know, through your email, through your intranet, through many organizations. Best-in-class organizations will actually have a public sort of signing of a proclamation or cutting of a ribbon that is videotaped and put on the intranet that sort of signifies the CEO or president of your organization being solidly behind a program like this so that it's not just perceived as another HR program du jour. Those are some strategies. Another strategy is really to launch like a flex fair or a flex day. One manufacturer in the Midwest launched a career fair, but it was a flex fair where there were IT specialists, benefits specialists, the flexible work team were all there really to help answer questions about connectivity, about applying for flexible work arrangement, et cetera. So I think more, and then you want to make sure that you're actively communicating that within your organization through the communication vehicles you already have. So those would be some suggestions about the importance of communicating with associates, and then also really to when we think about really what are some tactical ways that we can do that. I hope I've provided some suggestions there too. So I'd like to, at this point, turn to just give you a brief summary of what has taken place, what I was basically hearing from managers in a lot of the recent manager training sessions that I did. So just to kind of set the context, I was brought into a company to really help them train their managers as part of a rollout of their new flexible work policy. And so I got to see firsthand from them, from these managers, what some of the issues were that would have been concerns that were big enough that they would have either not supported the policy, ignored the policy, not discussed the policy with their employees. So it was really, you know, I know from a lot of the other work I've done really what to kind of anticipate, and certainly anyone who's been involved in a change management effort knows that we need to anticipate a certain amount of resistance. But some of their concerns were really kind of interesting and a little bit surprising. One of the biggest things that came out of this for me was this company had chosen to initiate a reason-neutral policy. So it was not to be discussed. Employees were not to disclose the reason for the flexible work arrangement request. And a lot of managers really were challenged to by that, that they, you know, would say, well, gosh, there's sort of a human nature. It's sort of human nature that I want to know why. And what I really helped them understand was that if you can make the determination of a flexible work arrangement and whether you're going to say yes or no based entirely on the business need, then it becomes a very objective, first of all, it's a very objective and familiar decision for managers. They're used to making sort of decisions about arrangements and suppliers and policies that are going to be good for the business anyway. So it's sort of like, oh, okay, this really isn't anything different than what I'm doing on a day-in, day-out basis. That was sort of one aspect of the comfort that the managers felt once they got over sort of the initial shock that they weren't going to be able to get their curiosity needs met. The other piece was really to think about it from the perspective of saying no, which was also a huge manager concern. What if I have to say no, and then isn't the associate going to get upset, and aren't they going to want to leave, and then isn't it worse that we had put this program in place? We're going to end up with more negativity between managers and employees than we would have if we hadn't put it into place at all. And what I really worked with them to help them understand was that by making the decision about saying yes or no to the flexible work arrangement reason neutral, what that enabled them to do was to have a conversation with the employee about the fact that this is a business decision so that it's not subjective. It's not that, well, you want to run a marathon and that's not important, but this person has a baby, so that is. But instead to say, you know what, really, quite honestly, this is just about whether or not it's going to work for the position that you're in, based on your work style, based on eligibility requirements, based on what our business needs are and sort of the requirements that our business has just on a day in, day out basis. So as I took them through that process, then they really did start to kind of relax a little bit, like, oh, okay, this isn't going to end up in these big kind of confrontations with employees if we have to say no. So that issue of saying no and the issue of fairness was one of the big issues that came up or concerns that came up with them. Another was this issue of, gosh, how do I know whether people are working, right? I mean, that's one of the big five. How do I know if people are going to be working from home, for example, that performance isn't going to slip both on an individual basis for the employee but also for the department overall? And also, really, how do I know if they're actually working? Now, this company has put in a core hour policy, so they aren't so far over to the other end of the spectrum where they're just saying, hey, everybody just get their work done. You know, they still do have some needs to have everybody working at the same time during the day. So what we took them through was really helping them understand that this isn't about managing face time and that what it really is about managing performance. Well, so, you know, you can say that and that's something that people sort of intuitively go, yeah, yeah, I get that. But what does that really mean in terms of the day-to-day aspects of us managing people, you know? So what I did was I took them through then what are the three big considerations when you're managing a flexible work team, and they're the things we talk about over and over and over again, that you have to communicate, communicate, communicate. It's the number one most critical management sort of approach that you have to take, which is to make sure that you're communicating with your employees when they're working from home so that you have the sense that you can see the work getting done. The second that we talk about all the time is really managing and monitoring performance. And the third is creating a cohesive sense of team. And so none of those things are rocket science, right? Like none of those things are like, oh, yeah, of course. Why didn't I think of that? They're all things that we know we're trained as managers that we need to do. But we also know we're not perfect. And certainly I take them through, the managers through, sharing some of what my shortfalls are as managers and get them to laugh a little bit about themselves. You know, do we always make sure we're setting deadlines every time we have a work-related conversation with an employee on the phone? I'm not always good at doing that, but it's really critical. And then I took them through the trust control continuum, which you can also find on our site, and along with a brief sort of discussion about it. And the point there really is to help managers understand that what's really easy for us to do as managers when we get uncomfortable about whether or not someone is actually working, what's really easy for us to do is to go of the employee, right? This person used to be a good employee, but now they're working from home, so now they're not. That's one way of kind of when we start to feel uncomfortable because we're not used to managing people that we can't see or managing flexible teams, we're not necessarily going to look at ourselves and our own source of discomfort. The first place we may go is to scapegoat the employee. The second place we may go is to scapegoat the flexible work arrangement, to say, well, if only I hadn't approved the flexible work arrangement, then I'd be in great shape and I wouldn't have to be feeling uncomfortable. If only we had butts in seats, that's how I know how to manage people, so I would be in much better shape and I wouldn't be so uncomfortable. So that's another sort of source of scapegoating when we feel discomfort. And really, the ultimate point in this trust control exercise is to say, you know what? What we really need to do as managers is look within ourselves. If I tend to be a manager who trusts my employees, that means that I may or may not really communicate and set deadlines the way I should because I just know the work's going to get done. Well, now I'm managing flexible workers, people are coming and going, and so now all of a sudden I may start to feel uncomfortable. It may not be the employees and it may not be the arrangement. It may actually be that I need to put some more structures in place to get that communication and performance going to a point that I can see it and then I get comfortable. On the other end then, in terms of being more of a control-oriented manager, being more of a micromanager invested in the process of how the work gets done, we also know, and it's pretty obvious, right, when I work with these managers to help them understand, like, gosh, that's kind of the no-brainer, right? I can't see the people working, so obviously I'm going to be uncomfortable. And so what I help them understand in that case is, guess what? You need the same tools that the manager who's oriented more on the trust end of this continuum, you need the same tools that they have to put in place in terms of communicating, in terms of setting goals and expectations. It may be daily flash reports so that you know what got done. So the point is that no matter where we start, we end up in the same place, and we need the same systems. And when they really started to process through that, you could see sort of this physical sort of relaxation kind of coming over them, like, yeah, okay, this isn't really rocket science. This is actually pretty straightforward stuff. There are things I know I'm already supposed to be doing, so I can kind of relax. So the third area where there was a lot of concern, and, you know, again, I worked with them to really help them sort of exhale and say it's okay for you to be worried about this, is this whole issue that if we put a flexible work program in place, everyone's going to want to telecommute every day, 365 days a year, from the very first day that the program rolls out. And what we know is that statistically that absolutely isn't true, but it's sort of this visceral response with managers, like, oh my gosh, I don't want to talk about this with my team, I don't want to tell them about the policy, right? Like I was saying earlier in this call, from an organizational basis, sometimes we'll have that same reaction, like, ooh, I don't want to publicize the policy. And one of the goals, obviously, when we're training managers, is to make sure that they're going to be proactively promoting the policy, right? That they're actually going to be making sure that their employees know that the policy exists, that they know that their particular manager is supportive of it, and all of that goes a long way to conveying the sense of, you know, kind of permission to ask or right to request. So if we can help managers get over this fear of, like, there are going to be crickets chirping in the cube farm, that is another way to kind of break down the barriers and help build support. So the way I did that with this particular group of managers was really to say, can you think of any reasons why employees actually wouldn't want to work from home? And most of them, you know, kind of shake their heads and are like, well, no, why? You know, this is like freedom. And so I helped them understand, you know, really, let's think about it. If I live in a studio apartment or I'm single living in a one-bedroom, the walls are going to start closing in on me after a while, right? And we all know there are other examples of why people wouldn't want to work from home. I was had lunch with a woman who was recently promoted to a VP earlier this week, and she was saying, you know, she had organized a flexible work arrangement and was working from home. Well, now she has twin 10-month-olds who just started walking, and now this is untenable for her. She can't be working from home right now because her kids don't get that she's working and that she can't just be with them. So by taking managers through actual examples of why people would want to get up and put makeup on and put shoes on and, you know, wear nice clothes and go off and talk about American Idol for the first 15 minutes of their day, that to help managers understand that there's a lot that people gain from going to a workplace, I think can be eye-opening, and it certainly was in their case. And then I help them understand, you know, many of our managers are already managing dispersed work teams. They may be managing multiple locations already. They may be managing sales forces where people are out and about all the time, or global teams. They may already be working with your location in China. And so just to help them understand, you know, a lot of the skills that they're already building and that their team members are building to learn how to and to address some of these challenges with dispersed teams are really the same skills that they can apply to managing their flex team. And then there were, you know, kind of standard considerations. I'd say the fourth kind of big consideration was this whole issue of a lack of or concern or lack of trust about whether or not the senior leaders are just sort of talking the talk or whether they're really walking the walk. You know, this idea that if I'm a flex manager and it's up to me to decide whether or not my team is going to work flexibly, what if I start doing it and now I'm sticking my neck out? You know, it's sort of like, what if the gun goes off on the track meet and I'm the only one who runs and now all eyes are on me and, you know, and I jump the gun or whatever. So I think there was a lot of concern about being the first one out of the gate and heading, you know, toward that culture change. What is the role I want to play? You know, do I want to, as a manager, be the early adopter? Is that kind of the role I play in the organization anyway, in which case it's really easy for me to get out in front, and I'm going to have a lot of courage and a lot of strength to just knock people over when the sludge starts coming. Like, ooh, you know, I noticed you've got three people out today, and how's that working? And, you know, are you the kind of manager who can stand up and be kind of a leader and not let that stuff worry you? Not all managers can, and there are other managers who are late to the party who want to be the last ones to get in the water until they know that it's safe. So understanding that there's really this whole spectrum of managers with different comfort levels, you know, how can we then, and that's some of the work that I do in this training, is really helping everybody at least get to a place of kind of comfort and safety. You know, and talking about the fact that this takes courage, one of the very tactical things I suggested to them was to pick a metric. Pick something you're already measuring in your organization, something in your department that you already measure that is a really clear determining factor for whether or not work is getting done. And just benchmark it today before the policy comes out. Just benchmark it. Look at where you are. And then give it 3 months. And then give it 6 months, and then give it 9 months, and look at the metric and see what's happening. We know, based on the case studies, the literature, the research, that performance should improve. But judge it for yourself. You know, pick a metric. And then when that sludge comes in, when other managers are like, whoa, you embrace that policy, you know, and how's that going for you, that you've got a quick zinger to come back and say, actually, you know, my call response times are up 10% over, you know, last quarter, and that's because most of my people are working on, you know, telecommute arrangements or whatever. So to be armed with some information, it was, you know, that they felt like that was something really easy that they could do. And then I also took them through setting up a virtual work agreement, and you can find information on our site about that. We've actually got a sample, and we describe how that works. But really, you know, to establish a virtual work or a flex teams agreement where you really identify the very specific behaviors that everybody needs to be exhibiting on a day-in and day-out basis. Kind of, I like to call it the things that you learn in the first 3 months on the job. You know, can you interrupt your manager or do people schedule appointments? You know, do we meet regularly, or do I just need to kind of send you an email when things happen? You know, those sorts of things. But anyway, you can get more information about that on the website. And then I think, you know, there were a lot of managers, probably the fifth and final point is really just that there were a lot of managers who still had this impression that this was kind of a perk or a reward for good performance, and kind of going back to that reason thing, like, well, do you have an hour and a half commute? Oh, okay, of course you can work flexibly. So there was some mindset shifting that really had to take place around this isn't a perk, this isn't a reward, this isn't, some people get it because they're just really good workers and other people don't. That what this really is about is a new way of working that drives business results. And so they did need, you know, some statistics. You know, we think of building the business case in terms of getting the flexible work arrangement approved in the first place, you know, to get the policy to be able to be something that's implemented on a company-wide basis. But one of the important takeaways, like I said, was really that the managers also need to hear that. We don't need to hit the point home the way we did with our executive level staff, but we really do need to help managers see, you know, first of all, we're not the only organization that's doing this kind of work, and in order to stay competitive from an attraction and retention of talent perspective, we've got to be doing it. To give some case examples, like we do when we're selling a program in, to give some case examples to them of, you know, here are some of our competitors and here's what's going on. It really helped build credibility for them so that it wasn't something that they could just sort of disregard or kind of, just, you know, sit through the hour-and-a-half training session and just wait it out until they could get out of there, that they really did start to get kind of the external perspective on why it was important. So I just kind of wanted to take the time to highlight really those big kind of five key areas. There were certainly other ones. And just to leave you with the idea that it's funny, I was talking with a company earlier this summer who was a very, very large organization who said, okay, well, so if we were going to embark on this training, then what we'll do is we'll bring you in and then you can tell us, you know, kind of your program and your curriculum, and then we'll convert that to our curriculum, and then our trainers will go out and train, you know, the over 100,000 employees that they had in this organization. And I said, well, time out here for a second. A big part of what managers need is this isn't so much skills-based training. There is some of that. There's lots of tactical best practice ideas and tips and pieces of advice that that they need. But this isn't so much kind of a training program in the true sense of training. That and this really played out in the training sessions that we just finished, that what's really critical for these managers is to hear that their fears and their concerns are not theirs alone, that and to give them an outlet to talk about those issues. So that can still be programmed, but I'm just bringing that point up because I think it's really important for us. There's a lot of e-training that's out there on, you know, managing virtual teams, and you can, you know, sign up for the e-training program, and you can make sure that your managers have gone through it before they manage a flex team, and there's value there. I'm not saying there isn't, but it really, really was reinforced in this in the trainings that we did that these managers need an opportunity to blow off some steam. They need an opportunity to actually be able to state their fears out loud, to have others around them, to have their peers say, oh, my gosh, that's what I'm worried about, too, or for everybody to be able to laugh about somebody's fear. And then for people to be, for managers to be able to say, you know what, I don't buy that. I don't believe it. And for them to hear from each other about someone else's experience and why they really need to kind of rethink their thinking. So it's important when we're doing this training, whether I'm doing it and Life Meets Work is doing it, or whether you're putting a program together for yourself, make sure that you're building in the opportunity for these managers to blow some steam, to be able to state their fears, to be able to get tactical, very targeted strategies back at them to help them work through not only stating their fear, but putting a plan of action together to address it. And I'll leave you with this, that the coolest thing at the end of the day on Wednesday was, well, it was around lunchtime. It was partway through the last day of training. This manager, I had been clued in by the client that this manager was going to be a tough cookie. He was going to be the one that was really, he's one of the people in the organization who was most resistive toward this program. And so I knew in advance that I needed to try to really draw out what some of his concerns and issues are. And at the end, without any prompting, he said, you know what, this training was really great. You know why? He said, because I was not going to talk with my team about this policy at all. I know it's coming, and I was just going to try to avoid it. And he said, now after the training, I realize that it's okay, and I'm going to schedule a meeting to talk with my team about it. So that was just one example across a whole bunch of training sessions, one example of how one manager's mind was changed as a result of being able to verbalize and vocalize his concerns and his fears and to hear very targeted advice and tips for and strategies for him to learn how to, you know, address it. So, okay, so we're really, I think, going to cut today's session short, and if there are any questions, I would ask you to unmute your phones now, and you can feel free to ask a question, and then otherwise I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Okay, well, thank you. We encourage you to check the events calendar so that you know when the teleconference will be next month, and we encourage you to submit questions in advance to teleconference@lifemeetswork.com. We'll see you next month. Thank you. Bye-bye.